You're listening to audio from the Cathedral Church of the Advent. Find out more at adventbirmingham.org.
Last week we looked at the second epistle or second letter of John, and this week I want to look at the next one, the third letter of John. These are two very short epistles in the New Testament towards the end. They often get overlooked because they're so short, but I thought for a session that we're having today and last week, this would be a really good time to look at these. You have on the little sheet of paper in front of you an entire book of the Bible, so you'll be able to go away from our session this morning saying you've read a whole book, you know, and as long as you don't tell them that it wasn't Genesis or Isaiah or something like that, no one will be any the wiser. You see, they think you've really put a lot of effort into it. All right, let's pray together, shall we, and we can begin. Our Father, thank you for this day and for this time that we have together now. Lord, I ask that you would bless us as we work and as we study together. Open your word to us, that we might understand it, that we might put it in our hearts, and that we may live for you in all that we think, in all that we say, and in all that we do. For Jesus' precious name's sake, we ask it. Amen. The two little letters that we're looking at are written by somebody who calls himself the elder. He doesn't give his name, but by tradition, we have been told that this was John the Apostle, the John who wrote the Gospel, who wrote the first letter, and who may have written also the book of Revelation. He doesn't identify himself by name, but he does by his office, by his ministry. He is the elder, and the term which is translated here as elder is the same term that we use today for priest or pastor in the church. So he's clearly somebody who has been appointed to a particular office in the church, and he is writing to it, to this church, in order to encourage it and in order to communicate something of the will of God to that church. We know from this letter, as we see as we read through it, that this isn't the first time he has written to this particular congregation. It may be that the other letter, the letter that we read last week, was what he had already sent. It's not clear, you see, one way or the other. Certainly that letter was addressed to the church as a whole, and it was addressed to them to encourage them, to praise them for the fact that they were holding the truth of the gospel of Christ, and that they were manifesting this in love for one another and in love for the truth that they were proclaiming. This week, we're dealing with what might be regarded as feedback, that clearly the elder was not actually in the congregation at the time. He was somewhere else. But people who were from this congregation had come to visit him and to tell him, to talk to him about what was going on. And in response to this, the elder writes this letter that we're going to read this morning together, which pinpoints three particular members of that church. I suppose you could say that the first letter, the second letter of John, Second John, is a kind of general letter to the church as a whole. And this third letter, you're getting into the detail of individual members of the congregation. And as you know, there's that old saying, the devil is in the detail. And that's what we're going to find as we look at this together this morning. So let's get into the first paragraph. The elder to the beloved Gaius, whom I love in truth. Beloved, I pray that all may go well with you and that you may be in good health as it goes well with your soul. For I rejoiced greatly when the brothers came and testified to your truth, as indeed you are walking in the truth. I have no greater joy than to hear that my children are walking in the truth. Again, you see that for John, the most important thing is the truth. You cannot build a church on any other foundation. See, the minute you go away from the truth, the minute you start to lie, even if it's for a good reason, you know, we all do it, don't we, from time to time. You just say, well, I don't know that I want to tell the whole truth about this. You know, we'll just sort of get our way around that. But the minute you do this, of course, you're heading for trouble. You know that phrase, oh, what a tangled web we weave when first we practice to deceive. See, it's a very dangerous thing to do. And John is aware of this, all right? And he's aware that there's a man called Gaius in the church who sets an example for the others. Gaius is the first of the three people that we're going to look at. Now, there was a book written many years ago. I think it was by Jerome K. Jerome, but I may be wrong. If I'm wrong, somebody correct me. Called Three Men in a Boat. Do you remember that book? You may have. I had to read it in school. Of course, can't remember anything about it now. That's school, I mean. You know, and I always think of that when I look at this epistle, because this is three men in a church. Now, I have to confess to you that a month ago, I had probably never heard of the University of Washington. I mean, if somebody had asked me about it, I could probably have guessed where it was, more or less, but I couldn't have told you anything about it. I mean, really nothing, all right? Nor was I intending to find out. But along came Christmas, and at Christmas time, out came a movie, which some of you may have seen, called The Boys in the Boat. Has anyone seen this? You have? It's a wonderful movie. I very strongly recommend that you go and see it if you get a chance. What's it about? It's about 8 or 9 students at the University of Washington who were poor. It was the Depression time in the 1930s, and they had to put their way through school, and they didn't really know how they were going to do this. Well, one of the ways of doing this was to join the rowing team at the university, because the rowing team apparently gave them a stipend, you know, something to sort of pay their way through school. None of these boys had ever done anything like this before. You know, they just weren't that type at all. They sort of got on this rowing team, and they had to learn to work as a team. Because if you're going to row a boat, you know, the rowing, I mean, it's a beautiful thing to watch when you watch it. But it's kind of like figure skating. To watch it, you think it's easy, anyone can do this. But if you actually try to do it, you find that it's one of the hardest things you can ever do, because you've got to be in total rhythm with everybody else. It's the ultimate in teamwork. You see, if one member of the team fails or decides to do his own thing or something like that, it's a disaster. And the movie is all about this, how individual people with no experience, no background, no idea of what they were expected to do, were shaped into a team which not only won the national championships, but was actually sent as the American entry to the Berlin Olympics in 1936 and came home with the gold medal. Now, this is a true story. That's the great thing about it. It's the truth. And I went out and bought the book and read the book, and I can tell you that it is a true story. I mean, it conforms to the book really quite well. Certainly a lot better than what most of what you hear on the news. It's true. And it's very inspiring for this reason, because it tells us, you see, the importance of teamwork and what teamwork can achieve, even with people who have no natural training, no particular ability as such, but they're molded together in this particular way. So I discovered that the University of Washington has a rowing team, and apparently it's still going strong today. More recently, this past week, I've also discovered that the University of Washington has a football team, or at least it did until Thursday. I don't know. I wouldn't want to bet on the future. But there again, you see the importance of teamwork, and this has come across very much, hasn't it, in the past few days. It's been very central to the way of thinking of people. And so this is, I think, very appropriate to look at today, how these three people in a church in a very long time ago were being taught by the elder the importance of teamwork, because that's really what it's all about. And first of all, this man, Gaius. What do we know about him? Well, you might say we don't know very much. In fact, we don't know anything apart from what's written here. That's true in a way. But if you study the ancient world, and particularly this particular time, you can actually learn quite a bit about this. Because this was a church where the people spoke Greek. Therefore, it was probably in the eastern part of the Mediterranean, either in Greece or somewhere over there, towards Palestine. These people had been conquered by the Romans. They're part of the Roman Empire. But they hadn't volunteered for that. They had been conquered and were dominated by Rome. But the Romans were very clever, you see, in dealing with their empire, because they would pick out particular people, influential people, people they felt they could trust one way or another, and grant them citizenship. And if you became a Roman citizen, you had a lot of privileges that other people didn't have. The Apostle Paul was a Roman citizen. And if you read through the New Testament, you find that on different times when he was arrested and so on, he said this to people who arrested him. He said, "I'm a citizen, you have to treat me properly. I have a right to be heard, my case to be heard," and so on. So it was a very important thing. Now, how do you know somebody becomes a Roman citizen? Well, in order to do this, in order to become a Roman citizen, you had to be sponsored by one. You see, it was a kind of sponsorship deal. And we don't know who it was who sponsored Paul's family. We know it wasn't him personally, but it was either his father or his grandfather. I personally think it was his grandfather, but that's, we don't know. Some Roman person called Paulus would have sponsored that family, that Jewish family, for Roman citizenship. The Roman citizenship was granted, and therefore the Jewish family took the name of their sponsor, Paulus, you see, and that's why Paul is called Paul. It's a Roman name that he took over in this way. Why did he get citizenship? Well, we don't really know that either, but it's possible they were a tent-making family, and while you probably wouldn't think very highly of that sort of thing nowadays, I mean, you know, why would tent-making be important? In ancient times, the Roman army would move around, and they lived in tents. So basically, I think the tent makers were military supply people, you know, and this was kind of a reward for their service. That's what I think, you see, happened in the case of the Apostle Paul. Here, with Gaius, we have a similar case. Gaius is a Roman name. More importantly, it was one of the names of the Roman emperor. You see, you've all heard of Julius Caesar, but you probably don't know that Julius Caesar's first name was Gaius. It was Gaius Julius Caesar. You see, that was his full name. And if the emperor, that is to say the government, state, gave you citizenship for whatever reason, you would take the name of the emperor. And this is why, if you read through the New Testament, all kinds of people are called Gaius. There's quite a few of them. Not because they were related. Not because there was some kind of trend, you know, that everybody's being called Elvis or something. Not this, you know, but because they were sponsored by the emperor, officially, for citizenship. What does this mean? Well, what kind of person would Gaius have been? He must have been well-off, influential, important in the place where he lived. I mean, the Romans wouldn't have bothered otherwise. You know, they pick their people. Whether he'd done something to deserve it, we have no idea about that. But he was certainly in the upper class of the society in which he lived. And we see this in his behavior. We see this in what is going on. Because look at the second paragraph. He says, "Beloved, it is a faithful thing you do in all your efforts for these brothers, strangers as they are, who testified to your love before the church. You will do well to send them on their journey in a manner worthy of God. For they have gone out for the sake of the name, accepting nothing from the Gentiles. Therefore, we ought to support people like these, that we may be fellow workers for the truth." Gaius was a man who used his resources in order to further the missionary work of the church. You see, these brothers that John is talking about, these are wandering preachers, teachers, and evangelists. They must have gone from place to place, relying on the hospitality that they could find in different places where they went. And wealthy people, people who could afford it, would put them up in their homes and give them a base, as it were, for their preaching and teaching ministry. And this is what Gaius did, you see. He had the resources to do this, but more than that, he had the motivation to do this. Because he didn't sit back, you know, and say, "Oh, well, I'm okay, don't worry about anybody else." He said, "I have been blessed by what God has done for me, and I want other people to share that blessing. I can't go out." I mean, we don't know what his circumstances were, but basically, he couldn't go out himself and do the preaching and teaching, whether he was tied by business or whatever it was, or whether he just wasn't gifted in that way. But he could offer support, you see. He could be a backup, as it were. He could be a resource for those who were doing this. And those who were doing it appreciated it. You see, they came back to John and they said, "Oh, that man, Gaius, you know, he's really great. We went there, we saw the way he received us, the way he treated us, not just the respect that he gave us, but he really welcomed us into his home, into his family. You see, we mattered to him, and we want you to know that." And of course, John is writing back, thanking Gaius for this. You see that Gaius was doing something which was of great importance for the building up of the church. And this is a challenge to us because there are some people, of course, in every church who are able to do this kind of thing. They may not be able to go out and preach and teach and do that, all that, but they have resources. They have the ability to offer hospitality, to open their homes to others, to support missionary endeavors here and there, depending on what it might be. And we need to encourage this. We need to ask ourselves, can I do this? Can I be part of this? You see, can I be a kind of Gaius in my own church, in my own circumstances? This is an important ministry of its own. It may not be something that you're doing up front and so on, you know, standing in the pulpit and all that kind of thing, but you may be a pillar of the church, a bulwark of the church in a quiet way, which will be appreciated by those who are the frontline troops, those who are going out and preaching and teaching in this way. You know, we send missionaries around the world. Some of them live in very difficult circumstances. They have very few resources of their own. They depend on us. You know, we who are blessed, we who have more than we really need, to be able to share with them. And this is an example of that. So Gaius is a good guy, you know, and this is what we see. However, that's not the whole story. Third paragraph. I have written something to the church, but Diotrephes, who likes to put himself first, does not acknowledge our authority. So if I come, I will bring up what he is doing, talking wicked nonsense against us. And not content with that, he refuses to welcome the brothers and also stops those who want to and puts them out of the church. This is a very different picture. Again, we don't know much about Diotrephes. In fact, we don't know anything other than what is written here. From his name, he has a Greek name, so he probably was not a Roman citizen, and therefore most likely of a slightly lower social class from Gaius. And he may have resented this, possible. See, we don't know. But there are many people, or many churches, I should say, many organizations, which have a Diotrephes in them. Somebody who basically wants to control what is going on. Maybe not from the front, you know, up front, but maybe in a more subtle kind of way. I remember very well my own home church many years ago. We had a wealthy businessman in the church. It was a small church, not like the Advent. It was quite a small church. This very wealthy man was a major supporter of the work. You know, a substantial portion of the church's budget came from him, which was very good. I mean, he was generous and gave a lot in that way. So, you know, that was the good side. The bad side, though, was that he expected the church to do what he wanted. And he would more or less say so. You know, he would say, like, if you don't sort of support this, but I want this, that, and the other, I'll leave and take my money with me. And he was such an important person from that point of view in the church that people were scared. And most of the time they would just to go along with him and say, we can't lose him, because where will we be if he leaves? Well, this went on for years, long before I was there. And it was going on when I first joined the church. And at some point, I can't remember now the details, but something came up, which this man was called Cyril, so that Cyril didn't agree with. And for some reason, I don't know why, but for some reason, the church dug its heels in and said, well, we're not surrendering on this point, whatever it was. And Cyril was as good as his word, you know, give him credit. He walked away and took his money with him. And so we had a parish meeting, and so what are we going to do? There's this big hole in our budget. You see, now that Cyril is gone, and how are we going to pay the bills? So we looked around and said, well, you know, it's up to us to do this. And so people dug a little bit deeper in their pockets. No one had anything like as much money as Cyril had. And no one could afford to give as much as Cyril did. But when we went round the entire congregation and everybody gave their little bit and so on, at the end of the year, we ended up with more money than we'd ever had before. So it was bye-bye, Cyril, you know. We didn't really mind in the end. But it was a real lesson to me at that time, you see, that God has a way of dealing with this sort of thing. But we do have to be careful, and we do have to realize when this kind of thing is happening, and if it's happening, to try to do something about it. You know, I always say to my students, there are two ways of obtaining eternal life. You can believe in Jesus, die and go to heaven. That's the officially approved way. Or you can get yourself appointed or elected to a church committee and object to everything. You know, become a nuisance. And other people, they don't know what to do, you know. What are they going to do? Are they going to poison your coffee? It won't work. Because the nuisance has given up coffee, you know. You're going to organize your meeting at 2 a.m. Oh, well, that's not going to work either, you see. You could dream up all sorts of ways that you might be able to persuade this person to leave. Or get rid of him in some way or other. But the person that we call the abominable no man never dies. You know, the abominable no man has eternal life. And these people exist, sadly, you know, and they can do a great deal of harm. Sometimes it's subtle, as it was with Diotrephes, apparently, in some cases. So sort of saying you get the advice of somebody whom you respect, like John, and this person will say, oh, well, you know, you don't want to listen to him. You know, he's too old. We used to do it like that, but we can't do that like that anymore, you know. Or you don't want to listen to him because he doesn't really know what it's all about. So you can spread rumors of this kind, you know, sort of destabilize people thinking and exercise a kind of control over the church. You see, basically by being nasty. And if you see this happening, if you see this coming, it takes great courage sometimes to stand up and say, look, this is what's going on. This has got to stop. You know, we don't do things this way. All right? But learn to spot it. Learn to realize, you know, who's sincere and who's just trying to, you know, claim a little thing, a little sort of empire for themselves. You stand back from it, of course, you know, look at this church, and you realize how pathetic Diotrephes must have been. It was a small church. It was subject to persecution. If the authorities found out it was going on, it wasn't really a big deal. But it was Diotrephes' little world, and he was going to keep it to himself if he could. See, be aware of this. Don't be like this. Please don't be like this. But spot it when you see it and develop a strategy against it, because you can't live like that. But that isn't the whole story either. Look at the next paragraph. Beloved, do not imitate evil, but imitate good. Whoever does good is from God. Whoever does evil has not seen God. Demetrius has received a good testimony from everyone and from truth itself. We also add our testimony, and you know that our testimony is true. This is the third man in the church, Demetrius. Again, a Greek name, so probably not the upper class, but just somebody in the church whom nobody really seems to know much about. We're not told much about him. But everybody realizes this is a good person. This is somebody who's solid. This is somebody you can rely on. This is somebody that represents, if you like, the ordinary, everyday, run-of-the-mill church member. And I always liked Demetrius because I think not many of us can be Gaius. We don't have that ability, perhaps. I hope and pray that none of us could be Diotrephes, although we probably could if we put our minds to it. We shouldn't be like that. We should be like Demetrius. People who don't put themselves forward, who don't try to run everything, who don't try to be a nuisance in order to attract attention or anything like that, but the kind of people you can just rely on, that you know are going to be there, that you know are going to be supportive. And that's something that you and I can actually do, you see, whoever we are. We don't have to be prominent or great or whatever it is. Just accept who we are, what we are, do what we can, and be part of the team. Be a team player in that way. Many of you will know that I work at Beeson Divinity School, Samford University, and of course this is an issue for us, you see, in our community and so on, working together. Do we work together? Are we a team? Well, sometimes we are and sometimes we aren't. And I tell you this, recently, the last couple of years, there used to be a lot of people from Beeson who came to the Advent. And some of them took quite prominent positions of prominent roles here. And then, as you know, various difficulties came, and those people left. Well, they may have left the Advent, but they didn't leave Beeson. So people I didn't see on Sunday, I did have to see Monday to Friday. And sometimes, you have to sort of tiptoe around that kind of thing. This is kind of delicate because you don't want to get into politics and discussions of this sort of this or that. And you have to work with them and all the rest of it. But it's not easy. It's not easy to do that. And it came home to me one day when the dean of the Divinity School came to me and said, a lot of our colleagues have left the Advent. He said, when are you leaving? And I looked him in the face and I said, I'm the rat who isn't leaving the sinking ship. That's my diplomatic response, you see. And he laughed and said, I said, no. I said, I'm in it for the long haul. Do I like everything that's going on? Well, no, of course not. If they asked me to run the show, I would run it differently. Of course. Most of the people would leave. That's true. I'd probably be run out of town, but so what? I'd be in control. Like everybody else, like you, I have my opinions. I have my preferences. I don't always like it when the decision goes against me. Because I think, oh, they'll live to regret that. And so on. And maybe I'm right. In fact, in circumstances like that, it's worse when you're right. Better to be wrong than to be able to gloat at the end and say, oh yes, well, I told you that all along. But you see, this is not what we're called to be. We're called to be people who support what is going on, people who work together as a team. We don't always get our own way. But we shouldn't want to get our own way. You see, what we should want is the greater prosperity, the greater good of the whole. And we should admit that that isn't necessarily going to be what I think or what I want. You know, it could be what other people want. It could be something we may have to learn from mistakes. Sometimes you have to make mistakes in order to learn. It's not a simple thing. But people like Demetrius, you see, these are the people who did that. These are the people who were there through thick and thin. These are the people who were there in the good times and the bad times. They were the ones who survived. And they were the ones who John points out. You see, probably most of the people, everyone in that congregation will have known about Gaius, prominent person. Everybody would have known about Diotrephes. But maybe not everybody would have known about Demetrius. They might have had some idea, oh yes, there's that person over there. But the apostle points him out, you see, picks him out and says, look at that man, you know. He's the kind of person you ought to be. And that's where I want to leave you this morning. This is the kind of thing that we ought to be like. You know, every single person in this room, every single person in this church is important. Everybody has a place. Everybody has a duty, a responsibility to keep the ship moving. Everybody has a challenge to row together, like those boys in the boat. And if we do that, and if we keep that in mind and keep the goal ahead of us, then we'll get to our destination and we'll succeed. So God bless you all, and have a great holiday tomorrow, those of you who are off, and we'll see you again. Thanks very much.
You've been listening to audio from the Cathedral Church of the Advent. If you live in Birmingham or find yourself visiting, we hope you will join us at one of our Sunday services. Find out more at adventbirmingham.org.